This is VOA News via remote. I'm Diane Roberts. Syrian opposition sources said Russian jets bombed rebel-held northwestern Syria Sunday in the most extensive strikes since a Turkish-Russian deal halted major fighting with a ceasefire nearly 6 months ago. Witnesses said the warplane struck the western outskirts of Idlib city and that there was heavy artillery shelling in mountainous regions in southern Idlib from nearby Syrian army outposts. There are no immediate reports of casualties. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the Security Council Saturday he cannot take any action on a U.S. declaration that all U.N. sanctions on Iran had been reimposed because, quote, there would appear to be uncertainty, end quote, on the issue. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said last month he triggered a 30-day process at the council leading to the return of U.N. sanctions on Iran Saturday evening that would also stop a conventional arms embargo on Tehran from expiring October 18th. But most Security Council members say Washington's move is void because Pompeo used a mechanism agreed under a 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, which the United States quit in 2018. Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson says he hopes the international community will support Iran against U.S. government action.
We expect, as it has been shown up until now, the international community and all countries in the world to stand against these reckless actions by the regime in the White House and speak in one voice to stop these actions by the regime in the White House.
You could read more about these stories or any of the news of the day by visiting us at voanews.com or downloading our app. This is VOA News. A U.S. judge early Sunday blocked the Commerce Department from requiring Apple and Google to remove WeChat for downloads by late Sunday. A U.S. magistrate judge in California said in an order that WeChat users who filed a lawsuit, quote, have shown serious questions going to the merits of the First Amendment claim, the balance of hardships tips in the plaintiff's favor, end quote. Meanwhile, U.S. President Donald Trump touted what he called a fantastic deal that could see Oracle and Walmart become U.S. tech partners for TikTok, which the president is seeking to ban over security concerns. About 100 million Americans use the short video app. Relatives of some of the 12 Hong Kong people arrested by China at sea last month demanded the city's government check on their condition and ensure lawyers appointed by the families, not the Chinese government, can meet with them. The 12 were arrested August 23rd for illegal entry into mainland Chinese waters after setting off from Hong Kong in a boat bound for self-ruled Taiwan. They were suspected of committing crimes in Hong Kong related to the anti-government protests that erupted last year. All are now being detained in neighboring Shenzhen. Forecasters say Tropical Storm Beta is making a slow crawl to the U.S. shores of Texas and Louisiana, casting worries about heavy rain, flooding, and storm surges across the Gulf Coast. The system is expected to make landfall sometime Monday. Three people have died after Cyclone Ionos, a rare storm known as a Metacane, battered Greece, flooding streets and homes, Greek authorities said Sunday. Ionos uprooted trees and caused power cuts on the Ionian island and the western Peloponnese. U.S. Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden will speak in Philadelphia today about his rival President Donald Trump's plan to name a third justice to the Supreme Court, a move that would cement a 6-3 conservative majority. President Trump said Saturday he'll make his nomination this week to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died Friday of cancer, and that it will probably be a woman. The president said at a campaign rally he has an obligation to make another Supreme Court nomination.
So Article 2 of our Constitution says the president shall nominate justices of the Supreme Court. I don't think it can be any more clear, can it? I don't think so.
Brazil's former leftist president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, said he is open to backing any candidate who can beat far-right President Jair Bolsonaro in the 2022 elections. And President Bolsonaro is scheduled to undergo surgery to remove a bladder stone Friday, according to a Brazilian newspaper. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
If government does not want to dialogue, then we'll sustain our strike until put the whole country in the disorder that they want and see how we end up.
Cameroonian groups plan a protest to demand immediate ceasefire of the conflict in the Anglophone part of the country.
We want to see a determination from government to do what is right. Because when what is right is done, we won't have the huge level of charges we're having right now.
The Nigerian Labour Congress issues an ultimatum to the government to reduce fuel and electricity tariffs.
Understand the politics and the industry. So that's my added advantage. Yes, I have a different background, but at the same time, I've been on the sidelines for 4 years, and I have a knack for what I'm doing. So I'm not wavered by pressure. I just need to execute. That's it. And this is how I'll prove the naysayers wrong.
And a Tanzanian football club appoints its first female CEO. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Cameroon opposition and civil society groups plan to organize a demonstration in the capital Yaoundé Tuesday. The organizers say they seek to pressure the government and separatist groups to ensure an immediate ceasefire in the ongoing conflict in the English parts of the country. The groups say they are a force for change, peace and democracy in Cameroon and are demanding institutional reforms. Responding to the plans for the protest, the government has deployed security forces along the major roads in the capital. The forces have been conducting searches of private cars, public transportation, and taxis. Attorney Ndong Christopher Mve is the Secretary General of the Cameroonian Renaissance Movement, or CRM. He tells me that the opposition groups will continue to pressure the government for institutional reforms and for a restoration of peace in the English-speaking areas by embarking on a series of protests across the country.
The march on the 22nd is to march peacefully and oust Bia. Bia should leave power because he has failed, including his government. That is the purpose of the manifestation, which is a constitutional right. It's inscribed in international instruments, calling on all Cameroonians of goodwill, those who know the needed change we need in this country, is to make sure this march is successful. We are marching for those conditions. That is it.
You talked about a peaceful protest. However, recent protests have been met with security forces clashing with protesters. How does your group or groups intend to ensure that the protest is peaceful?
There are no other ways to guarantee a peaceful protest other than announcing it, informing the authorities that be that we are going to march peacefully. And in the past, we have been marching peacefully. It is the security forces that are being deployed that provokes the population that are marching peacefully. A peaceful march is that which the people come out with no arms. But as we all know, it has been dropped into our ears that they will send some state agents, military men, police, and them to infiltrate around in civilian dress. Then at the time of peaceful protest, they will start breaking things on the way. We have decided on our own part that our militants should be vigilant as they are protesting. Anybody who destroys will just catch him and hand to the police. Say that is the man who destroyed. So that they themselves now will know that those people whom we shall catch destroying are not our militants. And then they have to prosecute them. That is the only way we have to go peacefully.
Why do these groups think that their call for a cessation of hostilities or ceasefire in the English-speaking areas where the conflicts are happening will be adhered to by the government? Because both international and local groups have called for a cessation of hostilities or ceasefire, yet the conflicts keep going on. What is different this time with your protests?
The difference this time around is to continue the pressure on government, because if you see the conflict that are going in the northwest, southwest, The government is comfortable because they say it is Anglophones, and that it's a minority that is trying to destabilize the country, and that the country is going on well. We say that the country is sick. It is sick now. The other 8 regions suffering from the bad governance, the bad human rights records, the killings of our brothers and sisters, creating divide and rule, bringing in theories like tribalism and all of that, which are not called for. All are from the same party, the ruling party. So it's a group of people who have held the country hostage. So if we get this pressure to bear on them, international bodies too will start mounting pressure, like the UN Security Council, like the European Union, like, and you know, all of those foreign powers will have to, in fact, put an eye on the problem that is happening in the country. Because for the other 8 regions to sit quiet and see what is happening in the other 2 Anglophone regions, it meaning that the people who are living in the Northwest, Southwest are animals, then they are human beings. So this pressure is to get the other 8 regions cry out aloud, so that pressure will bear on government, and government will be able now to bring the belligerents on the table to discuss the issues burning in this country. So that is the purport of the manifestation.
Will the groups be able to sustain the pressure in terms of the series of protests you plan to organize to put pressure on the government? Can you sustain it?
Sustaining the protests goes with the degree of the problem we have in front of us. Because 4 years today, they have been killing Anglophones in the Northwest and Southwest region, which we declare and say is a very bad thing, and that government cannot have its people, is ruling and is killing them. The ancestral forces are there to support us and nourish us, go through our demands. Number two, the electoral code and the electoral system is bad. And we cannot live and continue to live in a very bad setup in that kind of a situation. So the sustenance will be until that code and that system is revamped. And thirdly, if government does not want to dialogue, then we'll sustain our strike until put the whole country in the disorder that they want and see how we end up.
Attorney Ndong Christopher Mve is the Secretary General of the Cameroonian Renaissance Movement, CRM. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. The Nigeria Labour Congress has issued a 2-week ultimatum to the government to rescind the decision that led to fuel and electricity price increases. Emma Ogbuaja, the Secretary General of the group, says members of the organization will embark on an indefinite strike action across the country if the government fails to revert to the old prices. His remarks follow a government announcement increasing fuel and electricity prices. Officials of the ruling party say the government is not to blame for the economic challenges facing the country. They say it is due to gross mismanagement by the previous administrations, adding that the current government is trying to set the country on the right path to economic development. To learn more about efforts by the Labour group to engage the government to resolve their concerns, I reach Emma Ogbuaja, the General Secretary of the Nigeria Labour Congress.
Is born out of frustration we have felt with regards to some policies of government that has to do with a hike in the fuel prices as the cost of the premium motor spirit petrol, as is known in Nigeria, and then a hike in electricity tariffs, amongst other pressured policies that we see impacting very negatively on the working people and their families. We have tried to get the government understanding that this is not the right time to do it, not under the challenge of COVID, not under the challenge of intense hopelessness that people are feeling as a result of economic pressure arising from lockdown and the different pressures of COVID. It's clearly not helpful in any form, because if governance is about people, then clearly this cannot be seen as a move to salvage the position of the people. So we were compelled to seek this means to get a reversal.
Some Nigerians
and analysts are of the opinion that the ultimatum might not necessarily work because there wouldn't be a right time for such moves anyway. And they said it's unlikely the government will reverse its decision. What do you say to that?
We are putting out there the feelings of the people. There cannot be any other time to push across the feelings of the people. People were even a bit discomfited by the fact that they felt we had not taken action much earlier. Everybody is uncomfortable with the situation. Households are unable to sustain payments with regards to the electricity hike. The manufacturing sector is complaining bitterly because it might lead to closures in the alternative, job losses in the alternative, hikes in their products. And so clearly, people are suffering. So for the government, it's for them to think out of the box. You will be shocked that a country like Nigeria, that is one of the top-ranked crude oil-producing nations, does not refine a single barrel in the country. That is clearly unacceptable. It does not make sense.
Why are your members, as well as leadership of Nigeria's labor, displeased with the explanation given by the government that the price increase or the removal of subsidies that have led to this increase are unavoidable or inevitable?
Because we've been down this route before. It's a situation that has a history, and we have provided solutions long before now. We have pleaded with them if our refineries were working, the issue of hikes will not arise. What they call deregulation is simply hike in prices of products. And these hikes have components that don't make sense. You are having components of international taxation for a product that ordinarily should be sourced locally. All manner of external components that have nothing to do with real production costs if this was being produced locally. So for us, this inefficiency does not make sense. How is it going to make sense to any right-thinking person that will have to continue to import products and then pay the cost of the inefficiency? You push the cost of the inefficiency to the ordinary people. It's clearly not acceptable. It does not make sense to any right-thinking person.
Are you going to continue to engage with the government to reverse its decision? And if officials refuse to abide by this ultimatum, what happens next? And do you think there's a way out of this problem at this time?
Yeah, clearly we are seeking dialogue. We don't want dialogue with the deaf. We don't want a dialogue that says, hey, we've done it, you can go to hell. No, that won't be dialogue. We're seeking dialogue that shows certainty that the government is determined to make our four existing refineries work. We're seeking dialogue that seeks to make the electricity product that is coming from the private sector reasonable. How do you explain where people estimate bills rather than have people, Nigerians are willing to pay for what they consume, but you cannot have government say they are committing over 1.5 trillion to a private sector driven initiative. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. We want to see a determination from government to do what is right. Because when what is right is done, we won't have the huge level of charges we're having right now.
Emma Ogbuaja is the General Secretary of the Nigeria Labour Congress. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Still in Nigeria, the Adamawa Coalition Against Rape, a coalition of civil society groups, are calling for a rape law that will lead to the castration of convicted rapists. Supporters of the group say they draw inspiration from a similar law in Kaduna State. Governor Nasir Ahmed El-Rufai has updated the Kaduna State Penal Code to ensure a convicted rapist of a child under 14 years of age is medically castrated. Proponents say castration will serve as deterrent for offenders. Attorney Lubna Dodo, program manager of the International Federation of Women's Lawyers of FIDA in Adamawa State, says she supports the demands for the new law, adding that the current law appears insufficient to address the sharp increase in rape cases. She tells me that the new law will significantly serve as a deterrent to offenders who rape children under the age of 14.
Yes, the demand we are making is that we are demanding for castration in cases of rape of minors. While minors are being raped, the perpetrators should be castrated. Reason being that these minors live with this curse throughout their life. Every day of their life, they always remember this this trauma. So what we are advocating for is that it's for castration of perpetrators of rape of minors, so that they too will stay with this curse forever in their life and they will remember it in every day of their life.
Are you taking a cue from what happened in Kaduna when Governor L. Rufai just signed into law the punitive measure calling for castration for those convicted of rape of children of 14 years and under?
Yes, we are taking.
But some people are suggesting that it really does not address the problem, the core problem that you are trying to address. What do you say to that?
No, it will. It will really address the problem, because once it is being done on a person, first person, second person, I doubt if it will be done on the third person.
Some lawyers in Nigeria, human rights lawyers, are arguing that that law in Kaduna State, for which you are drawing inspiration from, is against the Nigeria Constitution, which prohibits torture. What is your response to that?
Is the rape committed by the perpetrator on a minor not torture? This touches the life of this minor throughout. There is also this likelihood that the survivor may not even survive the incident, because the survivor is a minor. That child may bleed to death.
Have you presented your petition to the governor in Adamawa State expressly expressing your call or demand?
No, we haven't. We haven't. The protest is sort of creating awareness and advocacy protest. We need to first get acceptance from the community first before we start making a move for the change.
So far, how have the various communities responded to your demand?
Yes, communities are responding because of these obvious reasons I have mentioned to you. That is, the survivor is a minor and there is likelihood that the survivor may not survive the incident. So as such, the perpetrators will equally have the same punishment of the castration.
So what really necessitated this call? Is it a recent surge in rape cases during the lockdown? What necessitated this?
No, the rape cases, has been rampant even before the lockdown. Cases are going high in the community.
So what is the message here to the people in Adamawa State with regards to your call?
Yes, the message is that we are demanding for acceptance. We want the community to accept this as a punishment. It is not on all the survivors of rape, but minors especially, because a minor doesn't know anything. A minor doesn't even know how to wear clothes or whatever reason you have. I have not seen anything why a minor should be raped.
Attorney Lubna Dodo is the program manager of the International Federation of Women's Lawyers, or FIDA, in Adamawa State. She spoke with me from Nigeria's Adamawa State's capital, Yola. The Aurora Humanitarian Initiative has named Fatun Adan and Ilwad Elman, a Somali mother and daughter human rights activist, as this year's prize laureate. They received the $1 million prize money to help save victims of sex trafficking and provide health care to marginalized populations. The Aurora Prize for Awakening Humanity is a global humanitarian award. Its mission is to recognize and support those who risk their own lives to save their lives, health, or freedom of others suffering as a result of violent conflict, atrocities, or other major human rights violations. For more about the award and how the money is administered, I reach Vartan Gregorian. He is the president of Carnegie Corporation of New York, co-founder of the Aurora Humanitarian Initiative, and member of the selection committee.
This award is founded by three individuals. One, Ruben Vartanian, whose great parents were saved by a righteous Turk during the Albanian genocide of 1915, during terrible time during World War I. And second one, Nubara Feyan, whose grandparents were saved by a German officer, whose Germany, remember, was part of alliance during or the Ottoman Empire during World War I. So their descendants decided to establish a gratitude in kind, return the kind of kindness shown on the individual basis to other groups and others who need human rights, as well as existence, as well as peace and harmony and everything that we advocate.
How did the Somali mother and daughter human rights activists receive this $1 million? How did this election happen?
They were finalists last time, and last week they have been another gays for several, 2-3 years. And this time they were finalists, and we chose among finalists them because of their record, their accomplishments. And also, the idea is not just to receive for good work, but somebody who risks his or her life and the fortune, the reputation, and others in order to help others survive and thrive. That's one of the reasons we had Miramar, we chose a Rohingya lawyer who was the first, one of the first lawyers to make the case for a Muslim ethnic community being pushed out of the country. Another one was Yazidis from Iraq, who at the risk of their lives saved many Yazidis. We have Sister Margareta, who rescued 30,000 orphans from her own tribe, alienating the tribe that called them unfaithful to the tribe.
With this award prize of $1 million, does your organization tell them specifically what to use the money for?
Yes, they list organizations that can receive this award. The recipient does not get the money. Recipient recommends organizations that get money that are in harmony with recipient's cause and action.
So looking forward, what impact do you think this award is having, particularly in Africa?
Well, in Africa, the following, that we have moral responsibility to help our fellow men and women and children, no matter where they are, who need champions, people who are not politicians, who are not seeking power, who are doing the right thing because their conscience, their tradition, their faith, their humanism, whatever prompted them, demands them to do good. They're not doing good advertising. Look at them, see what I'm doing. And they're persistent, not just one time, but lifetime, at the risk of their life, but as I mentioned already, reputation, their physical being, and everything, risking their goods, their home, everything, because causes that they support, women's rights, human rights, and others, unfortunately, are controversial in some countries. They're not normal. And as a result, we appreciate the risk, the idealism, altruism, and dedication of them.
Is there a mechanism to monitor the progress of what they are doing with the amount of money that you give them, specifically in Africa and beyond?
I'm glad you asked that, because we have accounting firms, legal firms, first of all, study the status of their organization, their annual reports, their giving thing, their board, everything. And then also we monitor and accounting and other firms monitor their actions. It's an investment, not a gift.
Vartan Gregorian is the president of Carnegie Corporation of New York, co-founder of the Aurora Humanitarian Initiative, and member of the selection committee. He spoke with me from New York here in the U.S.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Fali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. But first, Barbara Gonzalez is the newly appointed CEO of Tanzania's football powerhouse, Simba Sports Club. The 30-year-old becomes the youngest person and female to head a football club in the East African country. Analysts say the choice of Ms. Gonzalez is unusual, especially since football administration in Tanzania is predominantly dominated by men. Ms. Gonzalez holds a master's degree in political science and economics and a Bachelor of Arts in Economics and Political Science. She also studied at the International School of Tanganyika. She says her vision is to transform the club into a giant in Africa, drawing inspiration from successes in Western football clubs. To learn more about her vision, I reached Barbara Gonzalez in the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
I was asked and offered this role a year ago, and I turned it down. I've been a board member for over 2.5 years, but prior to that, I've been championing the transformation of the club from a members-owned club into a company limited by guarantee. So being part of this transaction on the side of the investor for the past 4 years, since December 2016, you know, I've been part and parcel of Simba's journey. So I think when they were considering, you know, what candidates to put on the table, which are typically seasoned men, this year, they really, really did push and said, you know, we need something different. We need to change. You've been driving this process, and we think you're the right fit for the job.
So what is your vision for Simba Football Club?
Our vision of the club is to be Africa's champions. It's been made very clear by our owners, by our fans. So in the next 5 to 10 years, Simba Sports Club will be champions of Africa. Now, how we expedite that is my role as a CEO. I need to create an enabling environment for the team to perform. I need to invest heavily in fantastic players. I need to invest heavily in equipment, but also to create a conducive environment so that players feel comfortable, whether it's a bonus structure, a nutrition system, recovery, to invest in that. So they're able to perform to the best of their abilities. My role as a CEO on the technical side is to facilitate good performance. But now, if you look at the non-technical side and what our vision is to generate revenue. You know, we need to be able to translate fans into customers of products and services. Al Ahly have been able to do this well. Other clubs in Europe have been able to do this well. They have their TVs up and running, fantastic merchandise system, fan cards, and so on. And we need to be able to do the same. And we want to be a fantastic example of this in Africa. And hopefully our peers will be able to look at us and say, you know, Simba's up to something. This is exactly what we want to do.
So let me ask you, and I know probably you have been asked this question before in the process of trying to get you to become the next CEO. What do you bring to the table that will transform the club?
Barbara Gonzalez brings a different perspective, a totally different background. You have to look, football management and administration in Africa as a whole has been typically run by very seasoned men in the industry. But now, if you look at Arsenal and Manchester United and these big clubs, what are they doing? They're poaching from the Barclays, from Absa, from people in the private sector who have a different way of thinking. We need to be able to commercialize the sport. And unfortunately, you can't if you still have the same wavelength, the same style of thinking. You know, I come from a consulting background. I worked at Deloitte for several years, and then I worked in a manufacturing and a conglomerate in Tanzania. That background, that commercial knowledge is invaluable to football because at the end of the day, the role of the CEO is to commercialize, to bring revenue. And if you have the day-in, day-out football administrator thought process, you really can transform the industry. So my role is to bring in fresh wave of thinking, new way of doing business, and hopefully bring my commercial knowledge into sports.
As you know, as a female administrator, that you would find or encounter challenges. How have you been able to manage such challenges and meet expectations or probably work as hard or twice as hard as your colleague or senior men will do in this position?
I think, you know, you said it correctly. As a woman, I need to work twice as hard to prove myself. But I believe similar to football is driven as by results on the pitch, but so is my performance off the pitch. You know, those who have worked with me can see my level of execution and delivery and all that have been assigned. So my role, you know, as a woman is not only to deliver, but deliver to the best of my abilities and everyone around me to be able to see the fruits of the seeds that I'm planting at this stage. So delivery and execution is key for me to succeed in this role. And unfortunately, being a woman, you're scrutinized even more. The pressure is even more. But for me, I'm not pushed by pressure. I am not wavering in any way because I've been in this industry for 4 years. I understand the pressure that comes with it. I understand the characters and I understand the politics and the industry. So that's my added advantage. Yes, I have a different background, but at the same time, I've been on the sidelines for 4 years and I have a knack for what I'm doing. So I'm not wavered by pressure. I just need to execute. That's it. And this is how I'll prove the naysayers wrong.
Barbara Gonzalez is the newly appointed CEO of Tanzania's football powerhouse, Simba Sports Club. She spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Botswana's National Assembly has rejected a call to rearm its game rangers due to a surge in rhinoceros poaching in recent years. Guns were taken away from the rangers in 2018, but an opposition party lawmaker had moved a motion to rearm the wildlife officers. For viewing, Kodisi Dube reports from the Botswana capital, Habaroni.
Botswana's legislators voted against the proposal brought before the National Assembly by an opposition member of parliament, Hoborego Nkawana. The motion to rearm wildlife officers was defeated Friday, with all ruling party members voting against it. Nkawana had argued recent poaching incidents necessitated equipping the rangers with guns.
It's a big loss. This would have been an opportunity to save our rhinos and other animals, elephants, particularly up in the north. So, yeah, well, maybe over time we'll see how we can address government on that issue.
Most of the poaching takes place in the thickets of Botswana's vast Okavango Delta. Minister of Environment, Natural Resources, Conservation and Tourism Permanent Secretary Utuwedzo Kobodo said the disarmament of the Wildlife Officers Unit in 2018 was not behind the rise in poaching incidents.
It's not like in the past the strategy succeeded because there was something different that was done that was not now been done in 2018. It is simply because the environmental conditions changed drastically.
Kobodo said rangers' anti-poaching efforts are focused further from the Delta in areas where there is less threat of armed poachers like the Galagadi Wildlife Preserve.
When it comes to anti-poaching, their efforts are largely focused in Galagadi. Those firearms, they had them in Galagadi, not in the Delta. So this is where I'm failing to see the relationship between the arms and rhino poaching. Because even if they could be having them today, they could be sitting with them in Galagadi.
Conservationist Mep Ives says the fight against poaching needs other interventions rather than a military approach.
The war against poaching, if you can call it a war, the battle against poaching, will not be sorted out by military means alone. You need to have crime investigators, in other words, intelligence, and the intelligence networks need to stretch between countries in SADC.
Minister of Environment, Natural Resources, Conservation and Tourism, Phil Dikering, recently told the National Assembly government was reviewing legislation preventing rangers from carrying weapons. Botswana government officials say rhino poaching has slowed significantly in recent months after a robust dehorning and translocation exercise. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Habaroni, Botswana.
The World Food Programme says many countries affected by conflict, COVID-19 and climate change are experiencing record levels of hunger, threatening the lives of thousands of people who do not have enough to eat. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
World Food Programme officials say they fear many more people will die from hunger due to the economic impact of COVID-19 than from the pandemic itself. The pandemic has infected more than 30 million people around the world, and nearly 1 million have died. The agency warns many people in countries of conflict are on the brink of starvation because lockdown measures aimed at curbing the coronavirus have destroyed jobs and livelihoods. For example, the WFP says nearly 22 million people in the Democratic Republic of the Congo are expected to face a hunger crisis because of increased violence coupled with COVID-19. WFP spokesman Thompson Thierry says years of conflict-induced hunger in Yemen makes the country of more than 30 million particularly vulnerable to sickness and death from the pandemic.
Some 20 million people are severely food insecure due to war, a collapsed economy, currency devaluation, crippling food prices, and the destruction of public infrastructure. We believe a further 3 million may now face starvation due to the virus.
Thierry was, until recently, the WFP spokesman in South Sudan. And he says he is very concerned about the impact of COVID-19 on a population weakened by years of relentless violence.
South Sudan was already on its knees, even before the emergence of COVID-19. 6.5 million people were expected to face severe food insecurity at the peak of the hunger season in July. We all thought we were on the path to peace in South Sudan. And then bang, we now have violence, renewed violence, more atrocities in Jonglei State.
It is the peak of the rainy season right now. Thierry says Jonglei State is drowning in floodwaters, economic challenges, conflict, and COVID-19. He says millions of people in Nigeria, Burkina Faso, and other countries are also facing crisis levels of COVID-induced hunger. Many, he warns, will die because they will be unable to put food on their tables. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to another edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Let's kick off with African football. Egyptian giants Al Ahly once again confirmed their domestic dominance, extending their record in the Egyptian Premier League by winning the 2019-2020 title. This is their 42nd in history and 5th in a row. Ahly clinched the title in style without even being on the pitch as their rivals Zamalek lost 1-0 to Aswan at the Cairo International Stadium on Friday. Al Ahly clinched the title with 7 games to spare. Zamalek's total points were 55, 17 shy of Al Ahly's 72, with 3 points to be deducted from Zamalek due to their no-showing against Al Ahly in the match day 4 fixture last February. The Red Devils guaranteed the title as Zamalek's highest possible tally will stop at 70 points if they win all their remaining 6 games. And the Sierra Leone government has decided to pay the women's footballers equal pay to their male counterparts. Now women national players will be paid the same as players in the men's national team. The commitment to equality has been made by the Sierra Leone government and covers appearance fees and winning bonuses. The new measures have even been backdated for the women's teams, who have been paid $2,000 each for participating in this year's Maiden West African Football Union Zone A tournament on home soil. Sports Minister Ibrahim Nyalenke told the media that his government's decision to harmonize payment for senior national teams is to improve the women's game and give equal treatment to all. Meanwhile, the Indomitable Lions of Cameroon will face Japan in a friendly match on October 9th as part of their preparation for the third round of group matches in the 2021 Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers, which are scheduled for November. The international friendly will be held in the Netherlands. And in athletics, Uganda's long-distance runner Jacob Kiplimo won yet another race. Kiplimo, who less than 2 weeks ago triumphed in the 5,000 meters race in Ostrava, crossed the line first in the 3,000 meters race in Rome. This was at the Diamond League, where he came in as one of the 3 favorites to win. The former IAAF cross-country junior champion came in at 7 minutes 26.4 seconds, beating his previous personal best of 7 minutes 43.73 seconds he had previously set in Doha in 2017. Pre-race favorite Inge Bresten finished second, while Australia's Stuart Maxson took third place. And the former head of Athletics World governing body, Lamina Diack, was last Wednesday found guilty by a French court of corruption in covering up Russian doping cases. He was sentenced 4 years in prison, of which 2 years were suspended. Diack, an 87-year-old Senegalese who led the International Association of Athletics, now renamed World Athletics, for 16 years, was also fined $600,000. But given his age, Diack is unlikely to go to prison and will most likely get conditional release, according to the judge. Diack said he would immediately lodge an appeal. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
In a 2020 slavery, Shenyang, if you match at your business, that are too insecure that you're just a watch your boom boom where you call that. Do your own things to fuck with. What if him love beg your money to? Can't pay rent and a bother you. Can't program me. Nanny never go a war for me. Sit down in a 2020 slavery. Me no know about you, but me know about me. No man can lick me. Some girl love them man more than how them love them one picnic. The whole man, some of them happy sex girl, must be mental. Them a fuck fi credential. You no want to the oral, but to drop your moral. Fi keep man, we have 24 girl, me no care. You don't touch me rear. Me and me one big man pass picnic stage. Me never serious me when me under here. So better you go on your ways, cause you can't tell me. What we do? Where we go? How we dress? Me no papi show. Me a the star, so me a no fan of you. Do what me wanna follow you. Me nah itch up under a man arm like Roland. Boss position, son of boy can't try program me. Rebel from day one. Real bad girl, son of boy can't try program me. Me nah need donation. Autonomous, can't try come program me. Nanny never go a war for me. Sit down in a 2020 slavery. Shenyang, if you match at your business, that a too insecure that you is a. Watch your pum pum, where you call that? In a 2020 slavery.
محلي محطوط على كريمة كعبك محلي والعود على القيمة
وتجيني تلاقيني لسه بخيري مش هتبقي لغيري ايوه انا غيري ما فيش
بنت الجيران شغلة لنا عناية وانا في المكان في خلق حواليا مش عايز حد ياخد باله من اللي انا فيه شفت القمر سهرني لاليا وهموت عليك رب العالم بيا سيب شباكك مفتوح ليه ليه تقفلي
بهوايا انت قاعده معايا عينيك ليا مرايا يا جمال مرايه العين خليكي لو هتمشي انا
محلي محطوط على كريمة كعبك محلي والعود على القيمة عليك بس تخلي العقل مجنون دوبت قلبي بخطوة من رجلي سحبت روحي سابتني وراحت لي أنا ليك وبيك ومعاكي
لازم أكون
شغلاني مش هقول لك تاني لو ألف حاجة وجعاني بشوف عينيك أرتاح يا ملاكي تروح حياتي فداكي أكتر وراكي وراكي في أي مكان يتراح بصيلي هز وشتك ميلي سيب عينيك تحكيلي اللي انت مخبياه
وقوليلي فهمتي ايه من عيني عيني من قبل ما اتكلم مش عايز غيرك عليك انا مصمم عود الجمال كل اللي فيك يتحاب دمك خفيف وضحكتك شربة زي العسل روحك يا حلوية عشان حبك محتاج لمليون قلب عشان حبك محتاج لمليون قلب
يا نيا لاتيو
عشيقة بيه
نا نا نا
Yo,
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the poor man's proverb is never quoted. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.